First case is 03-2099, State of Ohio versus Timothy Hancock. Mr. Wilhelm.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal this morning. Your Honors, this case never should have made it this far. It is never an abuse of discretion for a trial judge to take decisive action to avoid the risk of an arbitrary death sentence in a capital case. As we argue in our first proposition of law, the Court of Appeals failed to give the trial judge due deference on two issues that involve a matter of pure judicial discretion. First, it was within the trial judge's discretion to limit the number of exhibits that could be readmitted in the penalty phase. And second, it was completely within the judge's discretion to order a mistrial after the jury was discharged when the judge determined that the jury had considered exhibits from the trial phase that it was not allowed to have. Your Honors, the standard of review for this first proposition of law is not in dispute. The parties agree that it is an abuse of discretion standard of review. An abuse of discretion means more than just an error in judgment or a correct action or decision by the trial court. An abuse of discretion means that the trial judge, to be reversed, has to act in a manner that is unconscionable or arbitrary or unreasonable. Here, there was no abuse of discretion when the trial judge decided to limit the number of exhibits allowed to the jury in the penalty phase. First of all, there's no abuse of discretion because the prosecuting attorney at trial did not object on the record when the judge made his ruling on the record as to which exhibits would go back. If this error was so important that it connotes an abuse of discretion at this point on appeal, then why wasn't it important enough for the prosecutor to lodge an objection to give the judge an opportunity to correct the claimed egregious error so that the judge could revisit the number of exhibits to go back? Indeed, the prosecutor's claim of abuse of discretion is duplicitous because the prosecutor, at a pre-trial hearing on November 20th, 2001, agreed with the judge that it wasn't necessary to have a lot of trial phase exhibits to support argument in the penalty phase. If you look at pages 15 and 16 of that pre-trial conference, there was a discussion by the judge and the parties regarding the scope of evidence that should be argued to the jury regarding the aggravating circumstances and the nature and circumstances of the offense. And the trial judge noted that because these particular specifications were cut and dried, in other words, these specifications were uncontested facts. We have an A4 specification that was tried to the jury, and that's an uncontested fact. No one disputes that the offense took place at the Warrenal Correctional Institution. Then there was an A5 specification that was tried to the court after the jury, and there's no dispute about that either because that's proved simply by a judgment of a prior conviction. So the judge looked at these unique specifications and decided that they're cut and dried. And the judge said to the prosecutor, look, for your opening argument, all you need to do is identify these two specifications and then sit down. And the prosecutor agreed. So it's duplicitous for the prosecutor to argue abuse of discretion when the judge decided to limit the amount of exhibits that could go back to the jury in the penalty phase, when first of all, the prosecutor never objected, and second, the prosecutor agreed that for opening argument, all the prosecutor had to do in the penalty phase was identify the two specifications and sit down. And that's because these specifications are cut and dry. They're uncontested facts. Mm-hmm. Also, there's no abuse of discretion here in the judge's decision to limit the number of exhibits that the jury could have for the penalty phase because the ruling that the judge made was sufficient to protect the state's interests to argue for the death sentence. The trial court allowed the jury to consider four exhibits from the trial phase and the penalty phase. One was State's Exhibit 21. That was the judgment entry of the prior purposeful murder conviction. Now, the jury needed to have that because that specification was not tried to the jury, it was tried to the court. So the judge allowed that to go back to the jury, rightfully so. And the judge also allowed State's Exhibits 23, 24, and 25 to go back to the jury in the penalty phase. Again, the state needed those exhibits because those were three sets of medical records, and those were relevant to the seminal mitigation issue in this case, which is Mr. Hancock's severe mental illness under B3. The state needed to have those medical records so that the state could argue or attempt to argue rebuttal of the B3 mitigating factor. So the judge gave the state sufficient exhibits to try to prove its case at the penalty phase. No abuse of discretion. And there's no abuse of discretion because the exhibits that the judge kept from the jury, which ultimately went back and the jury improperly considered in the penalty phase, were not relevant to the aggravating circumstances, or they had only marginal relevance to the aggravating circumstances. As this court noted in State versus Lamar, trial phase evidence that has only a tenuous link to aggravating circumstances should not go back to the jury in the penalty phase. Therefore, under the rationale of Lamar, it's not an abuse of discretion for the judge to limit trial phase exhibits or evidence that has only a tenuous link to the aggravating circumstances. And again, these aggravating circumstances were uncontested facts. The crime took place at Warren Correctional Institution. No need to illuminate that or further exemplify that with trial exhibits. And also, Mr. Hancock had a prior purposeful murder conviction under A5. Again, that's an uncontested fact. And if we look at, Your Honors, if we look at the exhibits that the judge kept out at the penalty phase, which ultimately went back to the jury as it shouldn't have, those exhibits were used by the prosecutor during closing argument at the trial phase to argue prior calculation and design. The ligatures were not supposed to go to the jury at the penalty phase, and the ligatures went back. But if you look at the transcript of closing argument, the prosecutor relied on the ligatures to argue that Mr. Hancock acted with prior calculation and design. Now, that's significant because prior calculation and design is not an element of either specification in this case. It's an element of the homicide, and as this court is aware, the homicide is not to be weighed in the sentencing phase. We've submitted State versus Monroe to this court as additional authority, and recently in Monroe, this court noted that it is within the trial judge's discretion to admit or exclude trial exhibits in the penalty phase, and that discretion won't be disturbed where the judge has carefully scrutinized the exhibits before ruling on them. Here, just as in Monroe, this trial judge carefully scrutinized the exhibits before ruling on them. The judge allowed exhibits back that would further the state's interest in seeking the death penalty, but the judge was careful to try to protect Mr. Hancock's rights to a fair penalty phase because the judge kept out those exhibits that had only a tenuous, at best, link to the aggravating circumstances.
Counsel, if we were to affirm the trial court, do we still need to reach any of the other issues, such as the severe mentally ill offender issue?
Your Honor, I believe if you were to affirm the trial court with regard to the mistrial issue, the only other issues that would, or the only issue then that would be necessary to review would be our proposition of law number 3, which is our claim that the state had no jurisdiction to proceed on the appeal, although I think perhaps even that one would be moot if we were sent back to the trial court and his actions were affirmed and the life without parole was reinstated as the sentence. I think therefore, if the first proposition of law were sustained, I think it's safe to say that the others would be rendered moot if the original sentence were imposed, because that would obviate the need to reach the double jeopardy claims or the jurisdictional claim, because Mr. Hancock would be in the same position that he should have been in before the Court of Appeals incorrectly decided this issue.
And you're not contesting competency issues, that he was competent to stand trial. You're contesting the severity of his mental illness in relation to the death penalty. Is that correct?
No, there was no challenge to his competence to be tried. That's correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, also, there was no abuse of discretion here when the judge ordered a mistrial after the judge discovered that the jury had considered exhibits that it was not allowed to have in the penalty phase. Foremost, all the judge was really trying to do when we get to the bottom of this issue is the judge was making a good faith effort to follow the law established by the United States Supreme Court that says death penalty cases are treated differently than other cases. The death is different principle directs state courts to treat capital sentencing procedures with a heightened degree of reliability and scrutiny, not only to avoid actual prejudice, but to avoid the appearance of an unreliable death sentence and to avoid the risk of an unreliable death sentence.
Under current statutes, you can impanel a separate panel to hear the penalty phase, can you not? For example, if you had a reversal on the penalty phase, you can go back and impanel a separate jury and retry that.
Yes, under 2906B, that's correct.
In declaring a mistrial, should the judge instead not have impaneled a new death penalty hearing panel instead of automatically just going ahead with his own decision?
Because he had
no recommendation at that point from the jury. I guess he did.
He ignored the recommendation.
He ignored the recommendation of the jury. Shouldn't he have not impaneled a new penalty phase jury?
I don't think that would have been a proper interpretation of the statute by the trial judge to do that, and here's why. That provision that allows for a new penalty phase deals with errors that are discovered by an appellate court. In other words, 2906B states that if this court or the Court of Appeals finds an error at the penalty phase, it may reverse and order a paneling of a new jury.
But
in other words, repealing the Penix issue.
When you declare a mistrial as a trial judge, that always requires the impaneling of a new jury. You don't have any power to do something about the case on your own. You have to start with a new trial. And so why is this any different? I mean, obviously the statute allows a new penalty jury. I don't understand why this judge had the power, in your opinion, to reach a decision on a case he had absolutely mistried.
Your Honor, my response to your question is that the judge did not abuse his discretion or act unconscionably in choosing this remedy, and here's why. Under 2903D2 and 2909O3F, when the judge receives a recommendation of death, he's to proceed upon an independent weighing based on the jury's death penalty recommendation. But it is not an abuse of discretion, and it is completely rational for the judge to assume that what the General Assembly intended the judge to have was a jury recommendation that was uncompromised, that was free from the risk of undue prejudice or undue influence on the jury's recommendation. And this judge made a determination that the error created the risk of undue influence or prejudice to the jury's recommendation. Therefore, it was not an abuse of discretion for the judge to decide that he could not proceed to weigh independently the jury's recommendation. And once again, I think this really all goes back, Your Honor, to the basic premise that what the judge was trying to do was ensure greater reliability in a capital case. If the judge had proceeded on that jury recommendation, there would have been a risk of an unreliable death sentence in this case, and that's what the judge recognized. The death is different principle means that the judge is required to give heightened scrutiny and heightened procedural protections to avoid the risk of an arbitrary death sentence.
But if he's declared a mistrial, it means that the entire penalty phase is null and void, correct?
Actually, Your Honor, this is important to note in response to that point. The judge found the error. The error came to the judge's attention after the jury was already discharged and after the penalty phase. So once again, I think that's a major factor in the remedy fashioned by the judge, because the judge had no...
But does a mistrial render the decision null and void that's rendered by a jury if you declare a mistrial once the jury's deliberated?
Yes, that's why the judge, within his discretion,
decided to
ignore the jury's death penalty recommendation.
So if the penalty phase is a mistrial, it's declared null and void, what authority does the judge, as a one-judge panel, have to go forward? He's now a one-judge panel, and he's rendering a verdict. on a case that he's declared null and void. I'm having trouble following his authority to proceed if he's declared a mistrial.
Well, I think what we're dealing with here, too, Your Honor, is a gap in this is in the statute. The statute doesn't provide any guidance to the judge what remedy to pursue when the judge sits, when we sit through the penalty phase, and when the judge receives a recommendation, and when the judge has good cause to believe that the recommendation may be compromised. So, as the revised code in the earlier provisions directs us to construe sentencing provisions more favorably in favor of the accused, I think it's not an abuse of discretion or unconscionable in this situation for the judge to recognize that I'm dealing with a gap in the sentencing statute. If I act upon the recommendation of the jury, there is a risk of an unreliable death sentence, and therefore, it is appropriate for the judge at that point, within his discretion, to sentence Mr. Hancock to life without parole.
Counsel, what authority do you have that supports your last statement that it's appropriate for the judge at that juncture to impose a sentence when the whole penalty phase is declared a mistrial, therefore it never happened? The recommendation is no longer valid. It's totally discounted by the judge. So what, in essence, what you have then is the guilt phase accomplished, and the judge taking it upon himself at that juncture to say, this is the sentence, without any statutory support, unless you can direct me to a statute that allows that.
Well, but I think, Your Honor, in response again, I think what the judge is faced with here is a bit of a gap in the statute. The statute requires the judge to proceed upon a jury's recommendation.
But you don't have a recommendation right now. Would we agree on that?
I beg your pardon?
You do not have a jury's recommendation upon the declaration of a mistrial. Do you agree with that?
I think it's a risk of a compromise recommendation.
No. Where's the authority for a compromised recommendation?
But Your Honor, there really is none within the framework of the statute.
You don't have a recommendation from the jury upon the declaration of a mistrial.
But the jury's recommendation came before the judge discovered the error and before the judge found it necessary to order the mistrial as the remedy. So what I'm saying is, at that point, the judge was ready to proceed with his review of the selection factors, to weigh the selection factors. The error was discovered at that point, and the judge was left to deal with a gap in the statute because the judge had a recommendation, but the judge had good cause to believe that the recommendation may have been compromised. So, without further specific direction from the General Assembly on this point, what my point is that it's not arbitrary or unconscionable for the judge to proceed to sentence by ignoring the jury's recommendation because, again, all of the case law from the Supreme Court directs a state court to treat death penalty cases with heightened degrees of scrutiny and extra procedural protections to avoid the mere risk or appearance of an unreliable death sentence.
But the judge would not have had to have declared a mistrial in order to do that. He could have accepted the jury's recommendation and then imposed a different sentence by rejecting the recommendation, right?
But at that
point, the court has that authority.
Well, I don't think the judge could, Your Honor. I don't think the judge. It would be proper for the judge to accept the jury's recommendation before the judge could reach an independent.
Maybe I didn't make my question clear. If the jury makes a recommendation to impose a death penalty, do you agree that a trial judge does not have to follow it and may impose an alternate sentence?
Yes, I agree with that. On the merits,
okay.
Weighing the selection factors on the merits.
So the different fact in this case is that the court took the extra step of declaring a mistrial with respect to the recommendation returned by the jury.
But I think, Your Honor, that there was no abuse of discretion here because in order for the judge...
I'm just trying to articulate the difference between the normal circumstance where the court has the authority to impose a sentence other than the recommended sentence from the jury, mm-hmm. and the facts of this case where the court took the extra step of declaring a mistrial with respect to the jury's recommendation.
Yes, sir, I understand, but...
Well, where is the issue, then, with respect to the defendant's right to a jury trial with respect to the penalty phase? How could the court abrogate that and just say, I'll decide it, without the right of the jury's intervention when the defendant has that right? He never waived it.
But what the trial court was trying to do is to protect Mr. Hancock's right to a jury, to a reliable jury recommendation.
But if he declared a mistrial, then there wasn't a trial on the recommendation, and he deprived the defendant of the right to a jury trial on that matter.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, in that I think what the judge had found was that the defendant's right to a jury recommendation under the statute and under the Eighth Amendment was potentially compromised and unduly influenced.
So he declared a mistrial, which would mean you'd start over again with a new trial on that issue. But instead he didn't.
But he
decided it.
But he couldn't start over because the only provision for impaneling a new jury rests under 29-2906B. That's an authority that the General Assembly has reserved to appellate courts. There's a gap in the statute that maybe the General Assembly needs to address to give the judge the option to order a new jury. But the point here, Your Honor, that I also want to stress is that the judge only does his independent review upon a jury's recommendation when the recommendation itself is free of risk of compromise.
Well,
I think if the judge had proceeded to weigh the selection factors, that meant that the judge would have had to have confidence that the recommendation he received was reliable under Eighth Amendment standards. And because the judge had due cause to believe that the recommendation may have been unduly influenced, the judge could rationally and not within an abuse of discretion decline to weigh a recommendation that was potentially tainted.
Would you agree if the opposite were true? The jury came back with life. He now declares a mistrial for whatever evidentiary reason went wrong, and now the judge decides to impose the death penalty.
No, the judge couldn't do that, and because the judge cannot impose the death penalty under 29-2903-D2 unless he has a recommendation by the trial jury. So if the jury recommends,
he's doing the same thing. He's making a decision on the penalty.
That would be outside the statute, Your Honor.
He has no penalty recommendation by the jury in front of him. He's acting as a one-judge panel. Wouldn't the proper resolution of this case, if we do not accept the state's proposition that there was no error in letting those exhibits go back, let's say if we reject that, is not the proper remedy to go back and re-impanel a new penalty phase juror?
Again, I disagree with that, and I disagree with it because in your hypothetical, Justice Stratton, where we're talking about the judge receiving a life recommendation that's tainted, the statute's clear. The judge would not be in a position to impose the death penalty if the judge got a life recommendation from the jury because the statute's clear about that.
But he has no recommendation from the jury. He's arbitrarily deciding a penalty case with no recommendation from a jury because it's null and void.
Your Honor, here's the seminal point of my argument today, and it's not arbitrary what the judge did, because it's never arbitrary or an abuse of discretion for a judge to take decisive action to try to avoid the risk of an arbitrary death sentence, because the law directs the judge to treat death penalty cases differently. And that's all this judge was doing. And when faced with a gap in the statute, and without the remedy that this court would have under 29-2906B, the judge was faced with a choice of proceeding upon a recommendation that the judge believed was tainted and potentially prejudicial to Mr. Hancock, or in taking the case from the jury at that point and sentencing Mr. Hancock to life.
Mr. Wilhelm, let me stop you. You have 6 minutes left. I'd like to hear your argument on the double jeopardy issue, the legal issue.
Yes, second, Mr. Chief
legal,
Justice.
The second issue.
Our argument boils down to this. We are arguing that we are distinguished from the Satizon versus Pennsylvania case because what the judge did, there's double jeopardy here because the judge was acting as a matter of pure discretion. In Satizon, what happened was there was a mistrial and the defendant appealed and he won a new trial and he went back and he got death on the new trial But the Pennsylvania statute directed the judge to impose life by operation of law upon a mistrial. Here we're arguing that this decision by the judge is the acquittal of a decision, it's the equivalent of an acquittal on the merits, because unlike the Pennsylvania case, the judge is not acting under operation of a statute. The judge is acting
but
within
there was
discretion.
No, there was no finding of acquittal here. Was there?
Not based on balancing
on the facts.
Of the, not based on balancing of the selection factors. That's correct. We concede that. Our point is that because this involves an act of judicial discretion and not a sentence imposed by operation of law, that that's the functional equivalent of an acquittal on the merits.
Counsel, your issue of acting within the court's discretion, I mean, normally you have a statute that allows the judge to act, and you have been arguing that there is no statute that requires the judge to do what the judge did. There was a gap. So in a sense, you're arguing against your own idea of abuse of discretion because the court had no discretion to act. I'd like to get to Proposition 3 because you mentioned that would be one that still lives. And the Court of Appeals really reviewed this case not on the sentence but on the procedure that we've been discussing, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals, the fatal error made by the Court of Appeals was that it treated this appeal as an appeal by the state on a question of procedure. And our point is simply that this really isn't about procedure, that the procedural claim is pretextual. And what the state is doing is using a procedural claim on appeal to get around challenging the sentence that was imposed on Mr. Hancock. And I support that with 2 points. First, if the state was so concerned about this egregious procedural error, then the state would have objected at trial, and it didn't. And second, what this appeal is really about is the state trying to get Mr. Hancock a death sentence, not trying to address a procedure. And I know that from reading the state's brief in the court below. The state asked the Court of Appeals to vacate Mr. Hancock's sentence using independent review. Well, if you're asking a court to vacate a sentence on independent review, that has nothing to do with the procedural error at trial. That goes to the ultimate sentence imposed. And as a matter of policy, if this court were to allow this appeal to proceed, it would be eviscerating the intent of the General Assembly, and it would allow a prosecutor to create a procedural pretext to take an appeal when at bottom what the state was trying to do is trying to get the sentence reversed. But the General Assembly has made it clear under 2953-08-B&D that the sentence for aggravated murder imposed is not subject to appeal.
Is there a difference between trying to get a sentence reversed and arguing that the judge had no right to even make a sentence?
There is, but that's not it. There may be, but I think if we look beyond the gloss of the argument procedurally made by the state and if we look at what's actually happening here, I think we see that it is not a challenge to procedure, it's a challenge to the sentence imposed.
Did they
even
challenge,
if there is an intellectual distinction between those two.
Did they challenge his right to even make a sentence, or did they simply argue that these exhibits should have been admitted and therefore there shouldn't have been a mistrial?
The latter.
Okay. Because I don't think I recall reading an argument from them that he had no authority at all.
It's the latter. They're arguing that the exhibits should have gone back properly so there was no basis for a mistrial. Okay. But then again, if we look at the substance of this, they never objected to that, and then they asked the Court of Appeals to reverse on independent review. So what they're really trying to do is get the sentence flipped, and the procedural claim is pretextual, and the intent of the General Assembly shouldn't be eviscerated through that. I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Wilhelm. Mr. Sievers.
Good morning. My name is Andy Sievers, and I'm here with co-counsel Mary Hand representing the state of Ohio in this matter. I'll be addressing the court about the issues related to the appellant's competency and mental condition, as well as a waiver of the physician-patient privilege. And with the court's indulgence, Ms. Hand will be addressing the court related to the issues of the mistrial, appellate court's jurisdiction, and double jeopardy, and any questions regarding the evidence in the trial court. The defendant waived his physician-patient privilege when he filed his not guilty by reason of insanity. The Supreme Court has held that when the defendant places his mental condition as an issue of the case, then the court may order the subject submit to a psychological examination. The Ohio legislature has codified the Supreme Court's decision and states that the defendant's competence or his insanity becomes a question, then he may be ordered to submit to an evaluation of his mental condition. And as part of that statute supporting the Supreme Court decision, the physician is ordered to examine the subject and consider all the relevant evidence, in addition to allowing the independent evaluation. The physician may evaluate the person pursuant to any of the other statutes related to that. Now, the physician-patient privilege does not exist between that patient and the examiner. The purpose behind the patient, the physician-patient privilege does not exist because that policy is that it's to protect the patient so they give a free-flowing information to the doctor. This purpose is not existent in an evaluation of this nature. The Second District Court of Appeals in Demon also stated that the public policy behind the privilege does not exist in this matter related to a patient, the physician-patient privilege related to other doctors. Since the evaluator must evaluate all relevant evidence, must consider the defendant's prior history in determining whether the defendant is sane or competent for the court's purposes. Found that the policy would not further the interests of justice to allow a defendant to claim that he is insane and then deprive the state of the only evidence or an effective means of testing the validity of the defense. Here, once the insanity defense was raised, the privilege became a discoverable material. Dr. Leher, the doctor for the state, examined the defendant. There's no privilege between his communications. Furthermore, the doctor looked at all relevant information, which included a large number of psychological records, as well as talking to several of his prior treating physicians. The defense or the appellant states that that privilege existed between those treating physicians. However, as explained previously, they did not exist due to the public policy and the waiver of his bringing this issue to the court. As well, the appellant claims that the examiner made statements in the trial that were improper according to the statute. However, Dr. Lehrer's order was to review the information and to present a report, and then, if called upon, testify in court related to his findings. He is not allowed to testify as to what the defendant told him for the purpose of determining guilt, but that's not what Dr. Lehrer did. He used the statements that he received from the appellant to determine whether the defendant was sane at the time of this offense. He used that as a foundation of his opinion and stated such. He examined the records as well as him, as well as other doctors, to determine his, to make his determination. Furthermore, the statements were harmless. It's harmless if the court finds that there's overwhelming evidence that the appellant's guilt, aside from this evidence, or that there was some indicia that error did not contribute to the appellant's conviction. This trial lasted several days and included testimony from several doctors. His mental and psychological records were brought up in almost every aspect of every testimony of every witness. There was nothing that wasn't brought up from Dr. Lehrer that wasn't brought up in the trial, except his statements that the defendant made, which turned out they differed from all the other psychological information that was provided. the fact that the defendant committed this crime when he was imprisoned in a cell with the victim, the only other occupant, and that he made confessions to not only police officers but also to investigators, would submit that his statements and the use of his statements by Dr. Lehr were harmless error. Furthermore, it's well established that a jury is presumed to follow the curative instructions by the trial court. The trial court took great care to instruct the jury that these statements made by Dr. Lehr were not to be used in the determination of guilt. He advised them that that they were only to use this information for the purposes of his evaluation on whether he was suffering from a severe mental disease or defect at the time, and whether or not he knew the wrongfulness of his act. And it's not offered on the issue of guilt or innocence. Next, I'd like to talk about the mitigation phase. The appellant claims that the trial court erred in failing to have the appellant evaluated for competency for failing to submit mitigation evidence. However, it fails for two reasons. One, there was mitigation evidence provided. Secondly, there was no indicia of incompetence. I'd first bring to the court's attention, as this court found recently on May 25th in Monroe, as well as in Tyler, in quoting Ashworth, that a court cannot compel an appellant to produce mitigation evidence. As the court's found that, you know, found it in the its deeply rooted beliefs that a defendant has a right to bring mitigation evidence, bring it forth and force a jury to consider that. The court cannot force them to forgo bringing mitigation evidence, that it would demean the appellant's ability to be a human and make his own decisions in what happens in his case. Gives him the right to decide what is in his best interest, not what the court believes is in his best interest. The appellant did not waive mitigation. He presented his own unsworn statement. He also submitted exhibits from his psychological record to support from the trial phase. He referred to testimony at the trial. And his appellant counsel also artfully argued based on evidence that was submitted at the trial phase. This court in Monroe stated that there was not a waiver of presentation of mitigation evidence on very much similar grounds, though there was one witness that did testify. In this case, we have additional exhibits of medical records that was presented, as well as a defendant's unsworn statement.
Counsel, the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, in the last week or so, decided a couple of cases in which they found there needs to be even greater attention to the arguments of ineffective assistance of counsel. Am I correct in that regard?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that case or those issues. Okay. However,
I haven't read it either, but I'm wondering.
Well, that may go to the second.
Whether that may go to this issue.
Well, it may go to the second prong, Your Honor, in that that not only was there not there was not a waiver, is that let's assume that there was a waiver. If there was a waiver, there was not sufficient indicia of incompetence, and that's where the attorney comes in. The attorney is one of the things that the court looks at to determine whether this defendant was competent. One of the things that the court, Supreme Court, and this court has over time found that has counsel been concerned about it? Did counsel file or address or bring up any concerns about the defendant's competency? Here, the defendant or the appellant filed a not guilty by reason of insanity plea. So they were at least aware that there were mental issues related. However, they failed to file a competency concern. What it's added to that is that there were numerous doctors seen by this appellant. There were numerous doctors, at least four, that testified at trial. None of them expressed any concern whether the defendant or the appellant was competent. Two of them were examined strictly for the purpose of the insanity, but they never expressed any interest or any concerns regarding the appellant's competency. Other things that the court looks to determine if there's any indicia of incompetence is how he behaved in court. There's nothing in the record to indicate there were any problems. They also look to the trial court to see if there's any indication that the trial court found of any competence concerns. The standard is that he has to have the mental capacity to understand the choice between life and death, and that he's making a knowing and intelligent decision not to pursue the presentation of evidence. In his unsworn statement, and when he was addressed by the court on whether he was going to present mitigation evidence, there was a colloquy between the trial court, the attorneys, and the appellant as, you know, are you sure you don't want to call any mitigation evidence? And they both indicated that the appellant has made his decision against counsel's suggestion, because in this case, counsel hired a mitigation expert who went out and investigated, as well as another doctor, I believe Dr. Baker, who was available. However, the appellant advised that he did not want to use those in his mitigation, as well as any of his family. In his unsworn statement, he also stated he understood what was facing the jury, what he was facing, what the jury had to decide, and he had his colloquy with them, stating he understood what he had done and what he could face, and that was his decision. I don't believe he came straight right out and said, you know, I want the death penalty. He got close, but he didn't quite say that. So he was clear in understanding of what he was facing and what his decision's results were. With that, there is also the argument that the sentence would be cruel and unusual punishment because the imposition of the death penalty against the appellant is because he is severely mentally ill. That first assumes that the appellant is severely mentally ill. And if one thing this case did do was inquire into the matters of his mental illness. There's much testimony and much evidence to the appellant's psychological issues. However, we have the expert who testified, Dr. Lehrer, who reviewed the medical records, talked to other doctors, who determined that though he had a personality disorder, an antisocial disorder, he was not severely mentally ill. The appellant's own expert claimed that he had some paranoid delusional issues. However, there was significant evidence that these were false claims. His imaginary friend of Murray really never existed. He even admitted to other doctors that he didn't exist. And the evidence pointed to that the defendant used this as a crutch, as a tool to get what he wanted in prison. He admitted that he was a little paranoid, but that was usual for a prisoner to feel that way, considering he had spent 10 years in prison. However, he is not severely mentally ill, and there's no evidence really to show that he was severely mentally ill. Now, the Supreme Court has held, the United States Supreme Court has held that we can't inflict the death penalty on a mentally retarded. And the appellant wants to say that this is just like that. However, the policy concerns that related to whether the prisoner is mentally retarded versus the mentally ill, that connection is not strong and tenuous at best. This appellant was able to function in the prison system fine until someone told him he had to have a cellmate. And he didn't want a cellmate, so he killed his cellmate.
Counsel, I'm interested in the argument you just wrapping up here. Your argument is that he did not have a severe mental illness,
Correct,
and that
Your Honor.
You feel there's plenty of evidence for that. By implication, or maybe I'm reading too much into it, I take it you feel if, in fact, he had a severe mental illness, that perhaps the same concerns that the U.S. Supreme Court found with respect to imposing death on someone who is mentally retarded would be valid issues for us to begin to consider in this state and across the nation.
That's a very difficult question to answer, and I'll explain why. Is that the basis of the Supreme Court decision is that they have a disability in the areas of reasoning, judgment, and control of their impulses, and that they don't act with the level of moral culpability. However, in mentally retarded, that's the way they are, and there's no changing that.
Yeah.
That's a permanent thing.
There is a lot of criticism, though, of the McNaughton test.
Right. As
not really getting to the heart of what we ought to be considering when we decide whether or not to impose death. It is the tripwire in terms of whether or not you can carry the day on not guilty by reason of insanity, but.
Right. And the problem with the mental illness issues is that there are so many, and they affect people in so many different ways. How the court's ever going to be able to determine whether someone fits within that category that they're not competent.
But the reason I'm asking you is you're a prosecutor, and I'm, and again, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I take it as a prosecutor, when you're making the decision whether or not to go for the death penalty, if you were convinced that there was a history of severe mental illness, that might very well weigh into your decision.
That is correct, Your Honor, and it's my personal belief is that there may be an issue of a severely mentally ill person that may meet the qualifications as expounded in Atkins versus Virginia. There may be one out there that does that. There may be issues, and that's something that needs to be evaluated. However,
this is not this case.
Okay. So it does apply. The appellant has raised the case of Ford versus Wainwright, saying that inflicting the penalty of death upon a person who is insane is prohibited. However, that case, it's important to note that they were really attacking the lack of procedures in evaluating the defendant, not necessarily what that person's mental ability was. They denied the fact-finding procedure because it failed to give them an adequate and afford a full and fair hearing on a critical issue such as this, so that they can make a decision on whether, you know, this mentally ill person was competent to be put to death penalty. I would note for the court that in Scott, this court found that the appellant in that case had suffered from a chronic, undifferentiated schizophrenia. And this trial court found that there was no evidence that he did not understand the nature of the death penalty or why it was being imposed on him. And that is the test. Is this severely mentally ill person? One, does he meet the Supreme Court test? But second, is he aware of the nature of the death penalty and why is it being imposed upon him? And it clearly, Mr. Hancock was aware of his circumstances and what the possibility and what the results could be, and his total disregard for that in his statement saying, hey, he's in life, I know, nothing's gonna happen to me. And he left it at that. With the court's indulgence, I'd ask to allow Mary Hand to come in and address some other issues.
Thank you, Mr. Sievers. Ms. Hand.
May it please the court, my name is Mary Hand, and I also represent the state in this matter. I'll be discussing the trial court's improper mistrial, the appellate jurisdiction, the admissibility of evidence, and the double jeopardy concerns the appellant raises. Under 2929.03 D and F, after the jury renders a decision of guilt, the jury then has to weigh the aggravating factors versus the mitigating circumstances. If they find that the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating circumstances, they must rule in favor of death. The trial court then does an independent review of both the aggravating factors and the mitigating circumstances. Then they must set forth in an opinion their specifics on how they came to that opinion. Contrary to appellant's assertion, the trial court in this case did not make a good faith effort to follow the law. The trial court usurped its statutorily defined role, which they had no authority to do.
Well, the trial court was trying to correct a mistake. Well, I mean, to give the trial court some credit, may have been wrong, but he was trying to correct a mistake. Isn't that true?
That is correct, Your Honor, but
the statute is not clear on what the trial judge should do when a mistake such as this is created or committed.
That is
agree with that?
This court has routinely held that any sentencing errors that will be reviewed by either the Ohio Supreme Court or the appellate court in these cases.
The appellate court has no right to review a sentence of death under our current statutes.
That is correct.
So Proposition 3 relates to that. How do you respond to that argument?
In this case, the state did not object to the verdict itself, more of the procedure, how they got to that verdict.
Did you argue the sentence as counsel for the defendant has stated to the appellate court? Did you actually attack the sentence itself with the appellate court?
We asked in the initial brief, we asked that they would do the independent weighing of the aggravating versus mitigating factors.
They don't have authority to do.
Which they do not have authority to do, which they remanded back to the trial court to do.
Why would the proper remedy not be for the trial court to impanel a new penalty jury?
In this case, the evidence that the trial court thought was inadmissible was truly admissible.
But it's a discretion standard, isn't it? I mean, if there had not been any problem with that going back to the jury room, let's say the judge had kept the evidence he excluded out of the jury room, you wouldn't really have been able to appeal his decision not to send it to the jury room, would you?
The ultimate appeal was on the mistrial itself, and the fact that the trial court did not have the statutory authority to do that.
But he was exercising discretion, kept out the evidence. Evidence mistakenly went back in. He exercised his discretion, declared a mistrial. And where he went wrong is then acting as a one-man jury instead of impaneling a new jury. Shouldn't that have been the proper remedy?
Well, there was
for the court of appeals to get to their position, they had to basically find that he abused his discretion in not sending the documents back, therefore no error. I mean, it was sort of a convoluted argument to get it back in front of him without impaneling a new jury, where the simple, cleaner argument would have been panel a new trial penalty or a penalty-phased jury.
Well, there was two issues on why the appellate court sent it back. First of all, he didn't have the authority to grant the mistrial. Secondly, the evidence that was excluded was not properly excluded because it was admissible at the stage, and he abused his discretion in rendering it inadmissible. In regards to the evidence was admissible pursuant to the Ohio Revised Code. 2929.03d explains that the prosecutor may introduce at trial any evidence raised at trial that is relevant to the aggravating circumstances the offender was found guilty of committing. Furthermore, it states that the jury should consider the relevant evidence raised at trial, the testimony, other evidence, statement of the offender, and arguments of counsel in determining if the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors.
Did the state object to what the judge was proposing go back to the jury? Did the state object so that the trial court could have ruled on your objection?
In this case, the state didn't need to object. It was the
state. Did it object, though?
It did not object.
Thank you.
It was its own motion to introduce the evidence. The evidence admitted was proper rebuttal evidence. The appellant in this matter brought up five different mitigating circumstances, including mental illness, duress, previous sexual abuse, history of drug and alcohol abuse, and the Warren Correctional Institution's alleged responsibility.
Let me stop you there, because I'm just interested in this whole line of thinking that the trial court abused its discretion. If we apply, as the U.S. Supreme Court says we must, apply a higher standard of scrutiny to death penalty cases, Isn't it difficult for us to say that the trial judge abused his discretion here when he's the one who knows the evidence, knows the impact the evidence may have on the jury, and he decides that that evidence should not have been admitted in the mitigation phase? I'm using my discretion to decide that, and it got admitted, and so we know what happened. But isn't it difficult for an appellate court to say, applying a high test of scrutiny in favor of the defendant in death cases, that the trial judge abused its discretion here? I mean, you can argue it both ways, but it seems to me that's where we give discretion to trial judges who are managing the case.
The hallmark of the death is different statutes and case law goes to point to the fact that the death penalty has to be reliably imposed. In this case, the appellate court sought to do that. They tried to do the death is different, to send it back, to have him do, the trial court do their statutory duty to make it reliable. So this wasn't different than any other case.
Without the help of a jury?
Correct.
In a death case?
The evidence was proper rebuttal evidence in that the appellant was not under duress and he was not fearful or coerced into his actions. The appellant took the time to rip the bed sheets, lace the sheets through the bed, and then strangle the victim. Thus, he was not forced to kill his cellmate. The ligatures themselves go to show that he was not under duress. They show that it was carefully planned and meticulously carried out. The photographs also show that it was both meticulously planned and carefully carried out. The other evidence that was at issue in this case was the audio tape statements of the defendant. In the audio tape statement, he admits that he did not want a cellmate. Furthermore, later on in the statement, he admits that he doesn't mind having a cellmate. The audio tape itself went to go both prove the mitigating circumstance in this case, that the Warren Correctional Institution was partially to blame, but it also was used as rebuttal evidence to show that they were not, because he did consent to have his cellmate in with him. In conclusion, the evidence was properly admissible as relevant evidence and as rebuttal evidence and was thus not prejudicial. Since the evidence was admissible, the court erred in declaring a mistrial and overriding the jury's recommendation of death. I'm now going to discuss briefly the double jeopardy clause of the United States Constitution and the Ohio Constitution, and how they were both not violated because double jeopardy never attached. The underlying premise of the double jeopardy clause of the United States and the Ohio Constitution is that an individual should not be twice punished for the same offense. In this case, there was no acquittal of the merits of the case. The key hallmark of double jeopardy clause focuses on whether the defendant was ever acquitted or not. In this case, to avoid doing an acquittal, the trial court declared a mistrial. Thus, double jeopardy does not attach. In conclusion, the trial court did not properly weigh the aggravating versus mitigating circumstances as required under 29-2903. There was no acquittal in this case, and thus double jeopardy does not attach. Since double jeopardy does not attach, the double jeopardy clause of the United States Constitution and the Ohio Constitution have not been violated. In summation, the trial court improperly declared a mistrial. The Court of Appeals, using the death as different, correctly held that the trial court abused its discretion by excluding admissible evidence. After remand, the appellant received the death penalty after the trial court correctly performed its statutory duty. All the appellate's errors in this case are without merit. In conclusion, the death penalty is both appropriate and proportionate in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hand. Mr. Wilhelm, you've saved a minute of your time.
Mr. Chief Justice, you're correct. We defer to trial courts because they are in a better position regarding the ability to see how jurors react to evidence. In this case, there were photographs, gruesome photographs of the victim that were considered in the trial phase and properly considered on the issue of guilt. But the judge made a ruling within his discretion that those would be potentially prejudicial to Mr. Hancock in the penalty phase. The judge was in a better position to watch the jurors as they saw those photographs and to see things that an appellate court couldn't, the jurors' reactions.
If the judge felt really strongly that that evidence had tipped the scales, even when it came back, the judge could have made an independent conclusion not to impose the death penalty, and that would be the end of the matter, wouldn't it?
Well, and this is what this comes down to, Your Honor, is the remedy chosen here, and I'll suggest that there was no abuse of discretion in that, because the judge can only proceed to do his independent weighing if he has a jury recommendation. Given the heightened degree of scrutiny that's afforded to capital cases, I don't think we can say that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge to ignore a jury recommendation that he thought was tainted. Then the judge was faced with the prospect of what remedy do I pursue, and since the statute only provides for a new penalty phase from an appellate court and not a trial court, it was not unconscionable for the judge to choose this remedy. I see my time is up. If I may ask the court's indulgence to just make one further point. During the state's attorney's argument, they addressed a claim that we argued that there was improperly no hearing on competency to waive mitigation. That's not one of our issues. That may have been raised in some other litigation in Mr. Hancock's case, but we have not argued that Mr. Hancock needed to have a competency evaluation to waive mitigation, because all mitigation wasn't waived. He did present mitigation from the trial phase of a severe mental illness. So,
thank you, Mr. Wilhelm. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.